My Muscle Project, we are throwing it back to May 2019 to one of the biggest shows we've ever done, and probably, not to say anything bad about Hazel Gale, but probably the most surprising as well, because we had never heard of Hazel Gale coming into the show, but she was highly recommended, and really just the response from the audience to this show was absolutely crazy. So what you will get out of this is really, I think, the mindset you need to take, avoiding burnout through the ups and downs of life, but also athletics, which she goes into primarily. And we obviously have had her on to a second episode. So if you love this episode, 464, you can just skip ahead a year and you'll see the next episode where we just dive into some of the more details around your mindset and some of the mental blocks that could be getting in the way of your performance.
Yeah, I think why I liked this episode and why we got such a good response from so many of the listeners for this episode was just because her concepts around mental health and I guess mental performance, mental fitness were just so new and so relatable. So her story is so relatable in many ways as well and so powerful. And I think it's why she's such a good therapist and so good at what she does. So very, very excited for this episode. I know you guys will definitely love listening to it again. If you guys haven't already, now is the time to become a Whoop member. We've had Will Ahmed, the founder of Whoop, on the podcast for the second time as well. So we dive into all the new stuff that Whoop is doing, all the stuff that they've improved over time. And this is an amazing company. This is a company that's gone from a Harvard dropout all the way up to, you know, a $1 billion company with 500 full-time employees worldwide. It's an incredible story. And it's only because it's an incredible product. And you guys can start analyzing your biofeedback 24/7, start getting insights into how your body's recovering, how it's handling stress, how you can reduce your injuries, how you can get better sleep. It's absolutely incredible. Since the time we put it on in the last 2 years, it's come such a long way and it's got so long to go as well. So I'm just so excited to be on board with a company like this as it's improving. And it's pretty much the market leader now when it comes to fitness wearables and trackers and all sorts of stuff around HRV and recovery. So make sure you guys check it out, themymuscleproject.com/whoop. That's WHOOP. And you can get a discount to pick up your first Whoop band. So jump on board if you haven't. And then once you do, or if you're listening to this and you're already a Whoop customer, join our Mind Muscle Project leaderboard. There's over 200 people on there as well. We compete every single day on who is the fittest, who sleeps the most, and who recovers the best. All right, and as well, supporting us on the show today is AXP, which are the performance side of Activated Nutrients. So AXP, they're giving away a free energy formula. So their energy formula is similar to a pre-workout, but I'd say the difference is this one is really smooth, consistent energy. So I don't really like pre-workouts because of the massive spike and the massive crash. This is not what you would get with their energy formula. It's all plant-based products, very smooth, like it does have some guarana in there, but it's a nice stimulant. So this is the kind of product I would create if I was creating supplements. And you guys, they're giving it away for free. Don't even have to pay shipping, nothing. It's absolutely free. All you got to do is go to the website, themymuscleproject.com/AXP, so our website, and you can pick up the details there to get yourself a free sample, get it shipped down. They're only doing it for us, the listeners. So this is your opportunity to get it for free, their energy formula at themymuscleproject.com/AXP. Those three letters is where you can check it out. Guys, very excited to bring back this episode, one of the best of all time with Hazel Gale. This is Lachlan Rouston.
This is Raph Friedman, and you're listening to the fittest podcast in Australia,
The Mind Muscle Project. Okay, Mind Muscle Project, welcome back to another episode today. We are bringing back the girl power. We've got more and more females on the show now, which is a nice balance. We've been told to request more girls to come on the show, so it's fantastic to welcome Hazel Gale to the show. Hazel out of the UK, pretty cool little rap sheet, you know, ex-boxer, now kind of working in the kind of mindset realm and helping people, you know, become better and kind of overcome anything that has them stuck and gets them. Gets them down, and I think that's pretty common these days. And so it is cool to have people that don't just talk about the body necessarily and nutrition, but also mindset and that sort of stuff. So an author as well. Hazel, maybe you could start with on the show where we kind of wanted to pick up was how does a girl get into fighting, and how does she take it to the professional level? Because that is uncommonly uncommon.
I've got the most cliched answer ever for that. I got into fighting because I followed a guy that I fancied through the door of the gym. And I really didn't think I was going to enjoy it at first, not because I wasn't aggressive, because I definitely was. And I was really also strong. Up until that point, I've been working in bars. My background is kind of all over the place. I was an art student and a singer. And then gave those things up because I didn't have the balls to pursue them, and then went to work in bars for a while. So I was stacking barrels and carrying boxes around. So I was strong, athletic, and this guy inspired me to go down to the gym. And he forced me to go down to the gym. He tried to make me go lots of times and I kept saying, I'm not interested. I'm more interested in smoking these fags and drinking this tequila. He eventually got me down there, and I walked through the door, and within 15 minutes, I'd completely fallen in love with it. I remember standing at the, you know, it was almost like a ballet bar at the edge of the, where you did leg raises to develop the strength to lift your legs up in unusual ways. And it was that point in the session, 15 minutes in, after a really tough warm up, and I was dying and bright red in the face, but I was thinking, something about this is amazing. And then I got kind of completely hooked. And a few months after that, I started to remember these sort of fighter fantasies that I'd had, like even when I was really little, that I'd completely forgotten were even there, because I didn't come from a boxing, or this was kickboxing at the time. I didn't come from a fight family at all. I came from an academic family. My mum was a politician and bacteriologist, and my dad was a genetic engineer. And so the idea of me smashing people in the face was totally alien, and it hadn't been on our radar when I was younger at all. So it was a bit of a departure, and at the same time it felt like a homecoming, because I could remember I really wanted to be like She-Ra or Cheetara from Thundercats when I was younger, and then obviously Buffy the Vampire Slayer a little bit later. And like this sort of came back in like this flood when I started doing it. I was like, oh my God, I'm doing something that I actually always wanted to do. So that's how I fell in love with the sport.
And tell us about that first 15 minutes again. I mean, take most girls, and this could be a generalization, but I don't think I'm far off here. They step into a fight gym, and their first reaction within 15 minutes is not, oh, I love this. So
halfway home in 15 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. So how did you, like, what was it about that moment that made you not go, oh, this is too much, and instead go, wow, I really want to do this?
Well, right, first of all, I will say that, of course, that is a generalization, and I think that it is changing. I feel like I have a duty to point that out.
Probably most boys are on their way home, though, in 15 minutes as well.
Yeah.
It's a fucking scary
most
place.
People, really. Yeah. Most people.
That is absolutely true. I think I'd always been aggressive. I was the type of person who, I was really good at arm wrestles. And so I went to Thailand and I arm wrestled like a load of US Navy sailors, like in a nightclub one time, and beat like half of them, and as a result got loads of drinks bought for me by all the Thai bartenders. And so I was always competitive, I was always strong, and I was always aggressive, and I was also always athletic at school. You know, I by the time I was at art school, I was drunk, but at school I was sporty. I was a sprinter and did a long jump and pretty much any sport I turned my hand to, I could do, because I was just sort of built for sport. So I was good at it, I guess. That's one of the things. And so I started throwing punches. My coordination was there. My strength was there. And it gave me this, I remember the sound of the thwack of the leather glove on the pads and on the bags, and just this sense of power that I felt that I'd been missing. And all sorts of things had happened to me up to that point. I'd been in an abusive relationship for a while, which I'm actually been writing about recently, because it's going to be in a book of short stories next year. And I kind of, now I look back, I can piece it together that it felt like something I had to do. And also it felt like something that I realized I could be good at. And I felt like I should have already been good at. I remember one of my school friends saying that she was almost annoyed with my teachers for not working out that I should have done this sooner when I told her I was doing it. So I just dived straight in, and I started overtraining right from the beginning. I gave up smoking, gave up drinking mostly, gave up the other stuff that I was doing that I shouldn't be doing. And just got completely into this fight world, and then overdid it within 2 years. I was starting to suffer from my enthusiasm.
You mean your body suffered from just too much training?
Both, yeah. I burnt out badly. That's why the reason I'm a therapist now is because I had to go through therapy to recover from burnout and eventually get back into the ring and then move on from that. But the I don't really know when it started. I think it probably started around 2 years in, but I was in complete denial of what was happening to me because I was so addicted to training and addicted to the sense of achievement that it gave me that I would ignore the warning signs from my body. So I remember one time I was up at about 1:30, not able to sleep. Warning sign number one, which I ignored. I was becoming really badly sleep deprived because I couldn't sleep. So my adrenaline was up.
Tired but wired. It's like the kind of name for the condition of overtraining where like you're exhausted all the time but you can't sleep.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And so I ignored that. And what did I think to do when I couldn't sleep at 2 a.m.? I thought, I'll just go to the gym. So I had keys to the gym. I was coaching. So I went down to the gym, tired but wired, got on the treadmill and did a 10-mile run. And I can just remember, it was dark. I didn't bother turning the lights on. I had my music on really loud. The cleaner came in halfway through and I was singing at the top of my voice and she was a bit like, this is a bit off. And I remember feeling superior at that point. Like I'd become so wedded to this idea that I was going to be an athlete, you know, with capital letters. And this was the thing that I was going to do that was going to make me special. And this was my identity. So even though I was doing something ridiculously self-destructive, I was kind of in my element, pushing myself way too hard. And then you fast forward a couple of months, maybe even a year or so from there. And I remember coming back from an England squad training session once and saying to my training partner, you know, when you've been training and afterwards you just have this overwhelming sick feeling and you have to lie down, but you can't get any rest and you feel like crap and you can't do anything for the rest of the day. And she said, no. And I'm like, oh. Oh, and I still didn't get it because I was like a relapsing addict. The minute I would take a rest for like a day, and the moment I started to feel any modicum of energy coming back, I'd be straight back down the gym again, overdoing it. And I just went through that pattern continuously because for me, there was no other way at that point to feel worthy of anything. If I was putting on weight or if I didn't have a fight coming up or if I wasn't maxing out my training sessions, I felt almost like, this is going to sound dramatic, but it felt a bit like a death of some important part of me, that this punch throwing Cheetara, She-Ra, Wonder Woman part of me that I'd awakened.
Yeah, no, it doesn't sound dramatic at all. We see it happen in our gyms all the time, as people create such a positive transformation initially with themselves. You know, they recapture so much of their like their physical body, but also their self-belief, you know. Life's been beating them down. they don't feel like they have much going for them. And then all of a sudden they, you know, because training gives you that immediate kind of, you know, gratification. It's like, I put that work in just then. And now instantly you're getting that high from the session. And so you feel really good straight away. And that feeling does become addictive. But then, like you're describing right now, the scales can tip from, you know, positive self-improvement to negative self-harm. And it's kind of a fine balance. Tell us about when it all came sort of crashing down. Where was like the end point for you where you had to, like you mentioned earlier, go to therapy?
Yeah. So again, time-wise, I can't really pinpoint it, but it was somewhere around sort of 3 years into the journey. I think two years into my time training, I won a national title. And I remember my coach at the time saying, this is a bad thing. And I was like, what? He was my boyfriend too, actually. I'm not sure if he was my boyfriend yet at that point, but he did become my boyfriend. And he said, this is a bad thing because now everyone's going to expect you to win everything and everyone's going to expect you to be really good and you actually haven't been training that long. So you're not going to be able to live up to the expectations. And he was so right. But in my head, I was like, nah, no bollocks to that. I'm going to be amazing. This is my thing. I'm Wonder Woman. So I ignored that. And then when it came round for when I had to defend the title a year later in the next nationals, by that point everything had fallen apart. I couldn't get the weight off because the fatigue was meaning that I was retaining loads of water, and I twisted my ankle in the lead up, and I ignored that. So I was doing all I was doing was getting my cardio in on an exercise bike, and eventually I didn't. Because I didn't make the weight, I didn't make it into the full contact. So this was still kickboxing, and the two categories I could compete in were full contact or light contact. Full contact's like boxing with kicks, but above the waist, so no leg kicks like in Thai. and it's in the ring, and light contact is the same, but on the mats. I didn't really like light contact much. I only like the full contact, but I was too heavy for it to be sensible for me to go into full contact. So I did the light contact and I just got so easily beaten. And everything just fell apart. I just felt awful about myself. This, I can remember sort of just lying in bed at night and thinking back to being in the middle of the fight and just being frozen still, partly by fear and partly by fatigue, and feeling completely betrayed by my body because it wasn't doing what I needed it to do. It just wasn't fighting, which is a metaphor for what was going on in, you know, my health at the time. I'd run out of fight. I'd pushed myself too hard and there was nothing left. So I went to see, well, I didn't go to therapy first. I went to GPs and I looked at supplements, and because the whole deal is I was feeling like a victim at the time. And all of this was about, I felt like a victim in life. And my rescuer, my knight in shining armor initially was kickboxing. But when we decide that someone or something is going to be a knight in shining armor, it never stays the knight in shining armor for long. It becomes the persecutor. It becomes the villain. And that's what happened with kickboxing when I burnt out. And I did the same thing with all of the GPs and the medical practitioners I went to. I was like, you're going to save me. And then when they couldn't in 5 minutes, I'd go, okay, that doesn't work. Let me find something else. And so I went through pretty much every option I could find. And each time, nothing made a dent in my symptoms. You know, I changed my diet. I tried a load of Eastern medicines after the Western ones. Nothing really did much. And each time I just lost a bit more hope, until eventually someone said, why don't you go to therapy? And I went to see a hypnotherapist because somebody had recommended this particular woman. And again, of course, I wanted it to be the instant savior, and it wasn't. But what she did do is get me, she appealed to the part of me that wanted to understand how the mind worked. And that's something I've always been interested in. So thankfully that bit of interest carried me through the work. I did the work part. If it had just been looking to save myself, I probably would have just dismissed that as ineffective, as I did with everything else. But I didn't with this. So I stuck with it, and then it started to have quite profound effects relatively quickly, just because finally I was actually asking myself the right questions, and I was also learning how to be calm, which I absolutely hadn't been able to do. I realized at that point that I'd been having panic attacks multiple times a day, but I hadn't even been aware of it because I was so used to this state of emotional arousal that, and also in such denial about what was really going on with me, that I was just ignoring them. And I was completely out of touch with my emotions. I didn't know any emotions. I was feeling fear all the time, but so reluctant to admit that because it didn't fit this identity that I'd picked for myself, that I just numbed everything out. So it was a really long journey from that point forward. It took years for me to really start to make a shift. And then once the shift started happening, it took years for my health to actually come back. But obviously, regardless of how hard it was, I wouldn't take it back now because it's changed everything in my life for the better.
Can you describe the physical symptoms that you were trying to cure that you felt like weren't, you know, like with the Western and the Eastern medicine, like it wasn't making a dent in before therapy?
Yeah, there were loads of them. I mean, so the sort of brain fog, not being able to think clearly, word access problems, like trying to speak and just finding that I couldn't remember the words I needed to say, sluggish, slow movements, slow reactions. A sore throat. I basically had a sore throat for years, and I started to pick up loads of allergies. So I became really allergic to dust and chlorine and cats. I had cats too, so that was a nightmare. And then this sort of all-encompassing sickness that kind of crept up from my belly right into my chest. I can remember that was the most horrible thing, because once that set in, I knew, because it would come in waves, but when that set in, I knew I was in for at least 5 or 6 days worth of basically nothing. And then psychologically, anxiety through the roof, and eventually depression, which I guess was kind of a coping mechanism for everything else, because depression just numbs everything out and just shuts you down. And so that crept on. And again, it would come in waves. There would be good days and bad days. But there were points, I can remember one point lying on the sofa. I was living with my boyfriend and my sister at the time, and I was meant to be at work coaching. and I couldn't move. And my boyfriend was angry with me because I wasn't going to work, and he was my boss as well as my boyfriend. And my sister was angry with me because they were both sick of me being just pathetic, and I can totally understand that. And they were both sort of saying, Hazel, you have to get up. And I just didn't even have the will to respond. I just was staring into the mid-distance and feeling nothing. I think that was probably the lowest point when I look back.
And were you still training during this time, or did it linger for months after you pulled back or stopped training?
I was trying to still train all of that time, but there were months, there were periods of months, I don't know how many, but I had to take time off. I think I was probably off for about 6 months at one point. But I was still coaching, so I would sneakily try to convince myself that I wasn't doing exercise by going down to the gym and then giving all of my students pad work for the entire session rather than putting them on the bags. You know, so really I was still trying to do it, but I was useless. I was really slow and sluggish, and it would just knock me back further every time I tried to do it. And then when I gradually did get back into it properly, so there were loads of false starts, trying to get back into it and then having to concede defeat again and then trying again. And that went on for God knows how long. But then when I started to really make a shift, and the thing that I did to make a shift, I mean, there were obviously lots of things that I did because I was using lots of different therapy techniques myself and also seeing therapists. But I think that the main thing that I did, and this comes back to the title of my book, The Mind Monster Solution, I felt like my anxiety was like a monster that lived inside me. Well, actually, I felt like it lived outside me because it didn't feel like it belonged to me. It felt like an imposition. But it was like this sort of shadowy thing that followed me around, and I was always checking over my shoulder for when it was going to turn up. And because I was running from, when you try to run from your emotions, you make them worse. Just like anyone knows, anyone who's got a sibling knows that when you're chased up the stairs, if you run from the person who's chasing you up the stairs, you're going to get really frightened, even when it's just your little sister. Yeah. And it's the same thing with this sort of monster that I was dealing with. The more I ran from it, the more frightening it became. And what therapy eventually enabled me to do was turn around and face it. And that was horrible, having to face the fear of not being good enough, the fear of being weak. These were two sort of really key things. It was like this, I'd been in denial of that my whole life. And these other things that I'd been through, the abusive relationship and this sort of bravado that I'd built up around me, was all about not accepting weakness and not accepting failure. So I had this horrible moment when I had to recognize that everything I'd been doing was just trying to counter this belief that I was pathetic and easily breached, basically. And then once I did that, I went through this process of learning to love this thing that I'd been calling a monster, of learning to accept it as a part of the deal, learning to accept my physical symptoms as messages to me about when I'm doing too much and when I'm not. So, you know, in a nutshell, I learned to experience my emotions and I learned to listen to my body. And when I did those things, it was like turning around from having been swimming upstream for a long time. And suddenly I felt like actually all of me could go in the right direction. And then that I still had loads of physical recovery to do at that point. But I started to see progress then. I had a big calendar on my wall where I would map out the bad days and the medium days and the good days in like a traffic light system. And at first it's just all red. And then there were these little windows of green. And the reason I needed to have it visually is because I know that when you're in a red stage, you'll totally forget that you had some green days the week before. So I wanted to see it. And then over time, you could just see that just the thing just switching from predominantly red to predominantly orange and then green. And the sense of progress was really, really empowering, and gradually it came back.
So it wasn't a quick fix ever. And I don't think it ever really is, but it was a month, if not years, in sort of healing yourself.
It was years, and I still didn't recover my strength fully. I had never recovered my strength fully. I mean, because I wasn't, even though I got back into fighting, and I had success when I got back into fighting, I still wasn't the level of fitness that I was before the burnout. It's possible I may be able to get there now, but I'm not interested in trying anymore, because that level of fitness is actually not really that healthy anyway, and I realize that now. So I'm happy now with health and and feeling good about myself rather than being completely ripped and being able to do 100 burpees in no time.
How was the, like, the process? You went from, you just mentioned red to orange to green. What were the, like, were you introducing new procedures or routines or habits to kind of help shift those colors? Like, was it morning routines? Was it journaling? Was it reading? Was it something like that that started to make a big difference?
Yeah, there was loads of things, because I basically, it was my whole life, so I was chucking everything at it. And by this point, you know, towards the end of my career, I was already practicing as a therapist too, so I was really in that space and I would do everything. A really big moment for me was, and that you can do this in journaling and you can do it in therapy, but memory reframing work. So recognizing the root, like the formative memories, the really young memories that contributed to the problem. And so they happen in sort of two categories, really. The were the ones that contributed to my belief system of not being good enough and being weak. And the ones that contributed to this sort of exaggerated values, that value that I put on being strong and impressive. And obviously the two are linked. But I did some, I remember one session, I write about this in my book. It's called Timeline. The process is called Timeline. It's an NLP technique, but we do it slightly differently in my therapy style. But my therapist, a guy called Trevor Sylvester, who's amazing, he helped me remember this memory of a sports day, probably around 1985. I was probably about 5 years old. And I was petrified of running this race, because partly probably because my dad was there. And my dad was really... a really competitive man and a really sporty man and a really great guy. Like, he was a really great guy, but he wasn't around that much because he worked as a scientist and was traveling all the time. In fact, he was in Australia a lot. We lived in Australia for a little while when I was younger. And so the fact that he was there on this sports day just heaped a load of extra pressure on. And I can remember the beginning, it's probably a confabulation now, but I think I can remember the beginning of the race and this just like fear in my body, and then running as fast as I can and not really understanding what I was doing, but winning the race, bearing in mind I'm 5, right? So this is probably a 20 meter race and it was probably extremely fun. I look back to it now and it feels like I was at the Olympics. So I ran this race and I won, and Dad scooped me up and he was so proud. And this, in that moment, I think that the relief was so extreme that my mind just went, all right, okay, what just happened? I just won something. I won something and Dad's here. I won something and Dad's here and Dad's happy. When I win something, I'm loved. And so when we were that young, everything's binary. So I would have been thinking, okay, so if I win, I'm loved. Oh, so what does that mean happens if I don't win? And so I saw when I went back to that memory that just how easy it can be to come to these really exaggerated and erroneous and then largely unconscious conclusions about what things mean. And I recognized my whole life zoomed into focus, that all of this fierce competitiveness that I'd been doing just made sense. Like, for a long time, my primary dating strategy was to get someone a bit drunk and then take them to a bar and smash them at pool and beat them in an arm wrestle. I thought that was, you know, oh, that was good. That was a winner. Because in my head, to be that this sort of aggressive winning person was the thing that brought me love and affection. So anything less than that was, you know, me being alone, me being not good enough and not wanted. So reframing that memory, and now that I use the monster metaphor, I think of that as that was like meeting my monster. That 5-year-old me who had that race is the original monster. But the more I fought against all of that, the bigger and the more I ran from it, this monster sort of turned into the adult version of itself, which was this horrible shadowy fear that had these horrible effects. But when I could see it just as my child thinking, it's way easier to accept it and even love it.
Do you feel like when you made this shift, you started accepting, you know, we've just referred to in the past as childhood traumas, but I mean, how you described it, it's less dramatic. But do you think when you start confronting those things and you change, or you mature, or you take the next evolution of who you are, that the people and the environments that you're around start to shift because you've shifted? Is that what you notice?
Absolutely. Yeah, and actually, evolution is the word I always use for it. And for me, when after that, I got back into boxing, but my relationship to boxing was completely different because I didn't have to win everything. And obviously, I'd try my hardest still, and I was still able to be competitive, but without the fear of failure, which totally changed. It meant that I could love the game. But also it meant that it led me out of boxing in the end, because I became so much more connected to other people. And because I was capable of experiencing my own emotions, I became capable of empathy. And when you're capable of empathy, it stops feeling so appealing to hurt other people. And the bottom line is that in boxing, the purpose is to hurt other people. You can't get into the ring and think, I'll try and win this without breaking their nose, because that would be mean. You can't do it that way. So it sort of faded out. And the other sort of really important moment on this journey was my penultimate fight. I only had one more because it was kind of, this should have been my last fight, really. But I won, it was a national title, and it was the elite national title. And this was the thing in boxing that I had set my mind on at that stage. I probably wasn't going to go much further because I already knew I was fading out and I was quite old. By this point, I was 35. And you can only box 14. So it was on the way out. So this was the one that I'd set my heart to. And even though it wasn't as big as the on-paper successes I'd had before, because in kickboxing, I won 2 world titles and a European title, but this was the one that mattered because this was the one I was going to do after the recovery and with this new mindset. And I can remember warming up and everything was just a bit different. Like, I was in my body for once and I was skipping, and I can remember sort of enjoying the dance of this skipping. The rope was sort of whistling past my ears, and I was in this room and I was looking around at everybody, so anxious. And fighters sitting with towels draped over their faces, and everyone really, really in their own space, because that's what happens before these competitions. No one wants to talk to anyone. But I was listening to my music and I felt okay. And when I went out to fight, I walked into the arena and I felt this weird sense of peace that had never, ever been there before. It was like I was still and set and grounded. And it almost felt like the crowd had been hushed by this crisp layer of freshly fallen snow. And there was a stillness in my mind that was interrupted solely by this curious little voice that says, "I've got this." And I got into the ring and I looked across at my opponent. I didn't know anything about my opponent. And she was a southpaw, meaning she was left-handed. And this is, you know, this is a sort of traditionally a nightmare for a lot of people, because it means the vast majority of people who spar are orthodox. So you come up against a good southpaw and it's tricky. That should have thrown me. It would have thrown me before, but it didn't. And the fight was one of the few fights that I had that I was in a sort of flow state the majority of the time, not the whole time, but I just couldn't really miss with my right hand. I was just throwing it constantly and she was just walking into it. And it wasn't as if I was doing it something. It was almost like my body was doing it for me, and I was kind of sitting back and watching and going, "Oh, that was a good choice." And then when I won, that was when the real difference happened. When I won, my hand was raised and I felt this surge of alien emotion. And I don't really know what that emotion was still, because I don't know if it was just happiness or pride or just a sense of achievement, or if it was because this particular goal had been achieved. But I could realize in that moment that I'd never, ever let a feeling like that into the ring before. Up until that point, when my hand had been raised, what I'd actually done was kind of drop my head and avert my eyes, because what I'd been feeling when I won, while I was still being chased by this "I'm not good enough" monster, what I'd felt was shame, because when I had a victory, I didn't feel deserving of it. So it was a lose-lose situation beforehand. If I lost, I felt like I died. And if I won, felt like I'd died, because I still didn't get to claim the victory. But on this day, my hand was raised and I actually felt it. And I had tears in my eyes. That had never happened before. And then this really magical thing happened, because I was not fighting against myself. Instead of looking down and sort of introspectively hoping that it was going to have filled some kind of emotional void in me, because I didn't need to do that, my automatic response was to look up and out and connect with the people who'd been there. So I remember finding my best friend in the audience, and I imagined my dad in the audience, because by this point he had passed away. And that was one of my biggest regrets. I never let him see me fight because I was so afraid the cracks would show. I never let him see me fight because the dad seeing me lose would have been the worst thing. And he wanted to come, he was really proud of me and he wanted to come, but I didn't let him come because I wanted to wait until I was like, I wanted to wait until I was She-Ra, until I was invincible before I'd let him come and see me. And then he died and I never was never given that opportunity. And that regret was present on that day. And at other times as well around that time, it's just this sense of regret that I'd, the really big sabotage that I had, the self-sabotage that I'd made was not letting anyone else in on the journey. So on this day when my hand was raised, I looked up and out and I just connected automatically with people because I was in connection. And it completely flipped. The reason this was the end of my boxing career really was this mindset really bedded in then. I realized that up until that point, I'd been working off this idea that I needed to be a victorious person in order to be worthy of the connection of others. Like I needed to be winning stuff in order to be good enough. But the truth is that it's the other way around. I think that we have to be in connection with others before we'll even be capable of experiencing victory. Otherwise, it just bounces us off us, or worse, hurts. And so that was just the turning point. I had one more fight after that, almost out of duty, and then it tapered off because it wasn't a thing I needed to do anymore. And I moved into full-time therapy and writing and much more creative stuff. Started playing the guitar, got back to singing, which I hadn't done in decades. And now my life is a much more colourful place.
That was very that was very well put. Yeah. That was good. I think we can tell you're a writer. So I have a question. I don't know if you've seen this documentary. We reviewed a documentary on our show, or maybe I reviewed it. Was the Avicii documentary? I don't know if you've seen it. No, are you aware of what happened to Avicii when before he passed?
No, fill me in.
Okay, so you know who he is, right? Avicii. You don't. Okay.
No.
So
who are we talking about?
Yeah. So Avicii is.
Names. I might know without the name.
No. He was a very famous DJ. So he basically.
Locke will sing you one of his songs.
Oh yeah. Nice. It's not happening. But he basically became one of like the most mainstream, best-selling, most requested, biggest DJs like almost overnight. Like he made this song called Levels and it was just like it was nuts, right? And anyway, he passed away, I think, I want to say 2015 or 16. And like in the documentary, it was about his life in the lead up to that. And when he got famous, he was like 21. So he was like really young. And before that, he was just a computer nerd. He just loved being on his computer. He loved late nights. And he was basically a Mozart, is how people described him. Is that how he approached music and how he composed music was completely different to other people. He had the song already made in his head. And it was just a matter of allowing other people to help him bring that out rather than making it up as he goes. Everyone always described it as like it was already done. He was just trying to figure out a way to get it out, whereas most people kind of make music and change it as they go. But he just knew, and as soon as he'd start, he'd just on a mission. But anyway, he was a very creative person, but he's also a very introverted person. And he did like 800 shows in like 7 years or something.
It was like 4 years maybe.
Yeah. It was nuts. It was just an absurd amount of shows. And obviously the lifestyle that goes along with, you know, Ultra Music Festival, DJs, you know, lots of drugs, lots of alcohol. And there's this like moment in the movie when he picks up that personality book. What's the, he picks up is it the 16 personalities book? Or he picks up some famous psychologist's book about understanding introverts and extroverts. Yep. And he obviously never had any sort of exposure to this stuff before, right? He's just a kid. He just got super famous, so he's living like this adult life, but he hasn't developed himself as a person. And he has this moment where he's like, this is Carl Jung's book. Yeah. And he's like, this is the craziest thing. This describes me. Like, I'm introvert, I'm like this, I'm like that. That's why I find it so hard to chat to people in this. And you could see exactly what you were describing before, is like he was so anxious and depressed because he found himself in this life that he didn't enjoy whatsoever. Not because that life necessarily is negative, but it wasn't for him. Like, it's such an extroverted life, and he's such an introverted person that is just constantly in this environment that like brings him a lot of like stress and anxiety. And he was like, he's trying to train and like get healthy during the thing. He starts getting these major health issues and he can't fix them. He's like trying to train. He's trying to eat better. He like, like you said, tried all these diets and stuff and nothing works. And every time he tries to get back into doing shows, he just makes himself worse. And he has to have like all this time off. He cancels like all his shows. Everyone's like, no, Avicii, you've booked all these tours. Like you've got to do it. You're going to lose all this money. He's like, I'm going to die if I do another show. I cannot do it. And just as you were describing, that was kind of like the exact same thing. But it kind of, and what it ended up coming down to is that it was a mental thing for him. He had to start getting therapy. He had to like be like zen and peaceful and go back to doing what he loves. So eventually he shrunk his circle down to like a handful of artists and close friends. And they just made music together and that sort of thing. They didn't describe exactly how he died, but he did die of an overdose. They do believe it was suicide. But a lot of people knew him as like a really talented, special person. And then where I'm going with this is there was actually another podcast I listened to with a guy called Mike Posner, also a very famous artist. Again, he was super young, got super famous really quickly, composed music for some of the biggest artists in the world, like wrote their songs. And what started happening is all the people that he knew around him in the famous music scene, they all started killing themselves. And everything that they had in common was they got famous too young and they live like this extraordinary life and they just weren't ready for it. And it just makes you think that like maybe that sort of life, maybe being a champion kickboxer, like maybe being super famous, all that stuff, it looks awesome from the outside, but it's not really for everyone. And if like the right person doesn't go into it under the right circumstances, it's like the worst thing for it. They would trade their spot with anyone to just live a normal life.
Yeah, I think it's a really excellent point. And that the need for boundaries becomes so much greater, and boundaries are an adult thing. You know, we don't even know, like I said, I didn't know when I was having panic attacks. I couldn't draw my line between okay and not okay then. I had no idea how to be that self-disciplined. I could do it now. But I think the really important thing about that, the people, especially a quick and dramatic rise to fame, like you were describing there, is that everything suddenly becomes about them. You know, everyone, all eyes are on them all the time. They'll have to, you know, even just down to the clothes they pick in the morning, like they'll be imagining people looking at them and judging them based on everything they're doing. And in terms of, we've evolved to experience, to look back at ourselves when we're in a state of fear, because it's fear is there to make sure that we don't walk off cliff edges and stuff. So we check back in to see if we're too close to the edge. And that works if we're on a street and we're a little bit too close to the curb and there's a bus coming. But if we put ourselves in this self-focused state perpetually, where we're on Instagram all the time and we're on Facebook all the time and everyone's asking us about stuff and then we're on stage and everything we're doing is constantly looking back at ourselves, we are just inviting this anxiety because our mind thinks, okay, we're checking on ourselves, so there must be a threat present. And this, I talk about this with clients all the time because this is horrible. The world is geared up to make people think that they're meant to be stars and that it's a good thing to be in the public eye and for everyone to admire them. But it isn't if you haven't got your boundaries in place and you aren't capable of doing it for the right kind of reason, because people chase and chase and chase and it's running from the monster again. Like, I'm not good enough now, but if I just get that thing, that achievement, that title, that win, then I'll be okay. But then we get it. And we think, okay, well, I still don't feel good enough. So obviously that didn't actually mean anything else. Now I need this next thing. And we can keep going and we just keep chasing, running from the beast and chasing this pot of gold that just gets further and further away because it's not actually the answer. When I work with clients, something that's really important is to get them to think about what their purpose is in what they're doing. So whether that, I work with lots of artistic people and writers and that's relatively easy with them. With athletes, it's a little harder. It's like your purpose can't be to be the best in the world. It can, but you're not going to have fun doing what you're doing if that's your purpose. That's the only thing here. And you also, we are geared up for purpose, right? So if we don't want to do the thing that will take away our sense of purpose. And so if my purpose is to be the best in the world, there will be unconscious resistance to becoming the best, because as soon as I'm the best, I've got no sense of purpose. There's only one place to go there, and that's down. So it can't be it. Can't be the whole story. But because the world is really bad at making us think that stuff is the whole story, it can take a lot of work to shift our mindset out of facing in and into facing out, and asking what the difference is that we actually want to make. For me, it was simple because I was already beginning to work as a therapist. And I realized that boxing was nothing to do with the difference I wanted to make. I wanted to help people face their own monsters, not make people bleed from the nose. So for me, it was an easy shift. But you see a lot of people retiring from something as intense as boxing. I'm sure it's exactly the same in CrossFit, and becoming very depressed very quickly because their purpose has been taken away and they don't know what to do with their time. So that shift, that question, like, how can I use everything that's happened in my life up until now, including the really bad stuff and the really hard stuff, how can I use that to make an impact on the world that is meaningful to me? And when we can answer that question, we can get out of that trap of facing in.
How hard do you think it is to find the answer to that question, how I can make an impact? Do you think a certain amount of living through what we just described, right, of running from the monster needs to happen? I just can't imagine being that enlightened at 21 and just knowing straight away. I think you can have an idea, but if you really haven't lived through a lot of those experiences, it's hard to imagine what the answer to that question is.
Yeah, I think that you have to... trauma with a capital T, but everyone's had some trauma with a capital T. A lowercase t. We don't need to have been through a big thing to have that sort of moment of epiphany when you recognize the difference you want to make. I think it is probably possible to start getting in touch with it as early as 21. But yeah, I mean, I wouldn't really expect people to get it 100% at that point. But if they're asking themselves the question, then at least they're facing out rather than in. And that starts to counter this anxiety-inducing mode already. If they're at least recognizing the effect they're having on the world, then they're practicing their ability to empathize, and that's when it starts to shift. There's lots of interesting stuff on empathy and adult states of development and child states of development, and it's all very linked. You know, the two things run, a state of victimhood and a state of being able to empathize are kind of like opposite ends of the spectrum, and we don't recognize that these two things are so completely linked together. People who feel victimized by life are also the ones who are just facing in and therefore not ever looking out and not connecting with people on an emotional level. And so they feel like life happens to them rather than they are doing life. And they'll feel like things on the outside have ultimate control over them. Like, the weather's bad, so I'm in a bad mood, as if the weather can possibly change somebody's internal state. And then there's this sort of scale that goes up to the other end of that scale. Robert Keegan called this trans-systemic thinking, which is not a very catchy title, but he did a big study on it in the 80s, looking at how many people were operating from a place of victimhood and how many people were in this autonomous place of trans-systemic thinking, where they could make decisions based on who they really wanted to be and what they really wanted to achieve in the moment, rather than following habits and bending to the will of others. And he found that only 1% of people tested into that top category. It's like, to have true autonomous control, you've got to be, you've got to be really one of the unicorns of this world. But there's been lots of work around this, and you can learn your way up the scale, and it should be something that we automatically do as we get older. But because it's not a perfect world and we don't all get the exposure to the things that we really need, it doesn't happen automatically. But that doesn't mean we can't choose it for ourselves by practicing things like empathy, self-awareness, and self-acceptance. Like, one of the key things that's come out of Keegan's work, it's actually another book, and I can't remember the name of the authors now, but they talk about learning your way up out of victimhood. And one of the key skills they talk about is being able to recognize the patterns that play out in life as patterns. So when we're a victim, the pattern just keeps happening, and we're just like, why me? As if we don't have any control over it. But at the other end of the scale, it's like, this is a pattern, whether it's a pattern of behavior or a pattern of emotion or a pattern of circumstance. Like, I found myself in this situation again, or I found myself in this type of relationship again. When we can take ownership and recognize if it's a pattern and I'm the common denominator, then I'm the cause for this. And we can start to see it as a pattern instead of reality. Then it gives us this distance to step back and go, okay, well, something's going on here. And if we can develop that skill, which does take some time and awareness, then we get to step away from these repetitive problems that happen. That moves us up this scale towards this other end. And all the time, we're also developing our ability to connect with people properly, which means that if we're at the victim end of the scale, we don't get love at the victim end of the scale. We get attachment, and we get heroes that turn into villains. We don't get success at the victim end of the scale because we don't feel like we have any control. Like, all the stuff that we want is at the other end of the scale, and it demands that we do the work to understand ourselves and to connect with others.
Oh man.
Is there a victimhood quiz you can do? Like, you know, you answer questions and how you respond to them.
No, I'll tell you what. Ask the ten closest people to you how fucking selfish you are. And if they all rank you extremely selfish, then you're definitely on the victimhood end for sure. Yeah.
Or you've got 10 asshole friends. That could just be bad luck.
Yeah, well, you've attracted them. You've attracted them, so that's why. When you're describing that, I mean, I've gone through some recent stuff like this recently and worked with a therapist. And it's exactly like all the things you just described is I've shifted from what I felt like has been a really selfish way of living. And I recognize it really, really quickly and easily in other people now to a place where I never linked it to empathy, but I just felt all of a sudden, yeah, way more connected to people. So I'll give you, like, because we work in a CrossFit gym community or like a boutique fitness community, it's a close group of people. And there was this particular day, like 2 weeks ago, where I stepped into the gym and I just felt like this, and I hadn't felt it in a while. And, you know, it's very easy to be the professional and just get people really good results and that sort of thing, but not ever really connect with people as much. There is some level of connection, but I guess our position or where we are in our businesses, we don't have to have that same level anymore. We kind of have the staff members in place for that. But that's not to say I don't want to still know the clients that come to my gym. And there was just like this overwhelming sense of like wanting to ask everyone how their day was and genuinely want to know what their day was like. And I even had this moment in, I would say it was probably like 3 weeks ago where, and this has never happened in my entire life, and he's probably listening to this now, but I called my dad and we spoke on the phone for like the stuff we always speak about, but we spoke for like an hour and a half just in the middle on a Wednesday. And then he was like, yeah, so I kind of got to go now. I was like, oh, but we were just having such a good chat. He's like, yeah, but I got stuff to do. I'm like, oh yeah, I suppose I do too. But it was weird. It was weird, but it's exactly what you just described. It's empathy. It's like all of a sudden I actually cared about what was in his day. It wasn't selfish. Yeah. It wasn't like, oh, I've got my own shit to do. Like, you know, dad will do his thing or whatever. And it's been like a really weird shift, but it's been nice. It's a lot less anxious, a lot more peaceful.
Yeah, it's the answer to everything. It's the answer to every problem. And when people, it's actually brought tears to my eyes hearing that story, because that means so much. These are the stories that come in when people come in after a difficult therapy journey and they've got a story like that. You know, they're on the way. You know that they're knocking at the door of whatever it is that they want, because they've stopped being in this victim world. There are two things that happen actually when people tend to get better. And one of them is this sense of connection, which happens with other people. And also, interestingly, often happens with nature as well. People come in with stories of noticing just how beautiful the sky was, or feeling at one with the nature around them on their walk and stuff like this. Mm. And then the other thing that happens is creativity. Because when we're at the victim end of the scale, that self-referencing, self-focused, scared place, because that's what it is, it's just fear that makes us do that. We're in a state of protection. And when we're in protection, we can't be in growth. We're in one or the other, either protection or growth. That's Freud's pleasure principle. So if we're in protection, we close down, we shut ourselves off, and we do not grow. So we won't take risks. We can't create, because we are just repeating things that we believe are safe. So everything stays the same and stagnant. But at the other end of the scale, we get to go into growth. So when we get that empathy place and we start to move away from victim, we become more creative just automatically. It doesn't mean that we start picking up paintbrushes. Some people will do it musically. Some people will do it just with logic. Some people will start writing. Some people will just find that they're coming up with better ideas at work because they're able to think laterally. But it happens for everyone, pretty much. Creativity comes back and empathy comes back. And this is why I put together the Mind Monster project, which is, you know, something obviously that runs in conjunction with my book, but it's kind of taken on a life of its own, where I ask people to think about, to imagine that they can see the part of their personality that makes them self-sabotage. And this will be, so for me, it was this shadow monster. It could be the part that makes them binge eat. It could be the part that makes them spend too much money or shout at their partner, or it could be an emotional thing like lingering resentment or whatever. And while we're in victim, we'll feel like a victim of this part. Like I said earlier, it didn't feel like me. My monster didn't feel like me. It felt like an imposition. And that will be what it's like. It's, we want to, when people are struggling with a problem and you ask them about this part and you ask them what they want to do with it, they'll say, I want to kill it, or I want to squash it, or I want to drop it in the bin. But we can't do that because it's a part of the self. And you just cannot wage war on yourself and then win. It's not possible. So there needs to be another way. And what I do with the Mind Monster Project is ask people to start building sort of a metaphorical narrative around this part. So start by visualizing it and drawing it or representing it in some way. I've got oil paintings, I've got a song, I've got animations and lots of angry scribbles. So represent it in some way and then answer a few simple questions about it, like if it had a name, what would it be? If it could speak, what would it say? To kind of imbuing it with this sort of fictional personality, which means that you can start to recognize it more easily, which helps massively with that skill of pattern recognition. Because instead of thinking, oh, I'm not good enough, you're like, oh, hang on a minute, this is just my I'm not good enough monster. It's Dave. And so you've got this sort of self-distancing in that moment. Like, I'm not dealing with ultimate failure here. It's just Dave again. It's just Dave doing his thing. So the reason I put the project together was because I wanted to make a space where it was a safe space, because most people can contribute monsters anonymously. A safe space for people to put their pain out there in a way that's both creative and inspires empathy. And it's wonderful because people look at the project and there'll be one monster. They just go, oh my God, this is like me. I get this one. This is exactly, I thought this is a wonderful one. I've sort of turned into the logo. It was one of the first ones I had. And it was sort of this scribble with these sort of scared eyes in the middle of it. And the words that this person has included, it's a fear of not being worthy monster. And it words like, it lives beside me, but just behind, like half a step behind. And everywhere I go, I sometimes think I'm free of it, but then just as I'm starting to achieve something, it will come back. And people read these things and they're like, oh my God, I get this. Even though there's hardly any detail in it in terms of specifics, it's just this metaphorical idea of what it feels like to feel unworthy or what it feels like to binge eat. And people can see themselves in it, which helps with this wonderful sense of connection, which has got to be a part of the journey. And if it inspires anyone, whether they send in their monster or just draw it at home or just visualize it, it's starting to tip them towards that creative end of the scale, which has got to be part of the healing process. There's been a really enjoyable and humbling thing to do. I've got hundreds now of these monsters across.
I'm going to draw mine and send it to you,
Dave.
Yeah, please send me a monster.
Dave and Bill.
I'll probably call him Ralph, I reckon.
His one is physical. One thing I always find amazing is how I think generally you think you're very unique when you're just living in your own your own life. But it's always incredible when someone gives you some sort of, we were doing like personality tests today, or just presents you something and you're like, holy shit, that is exactly me. And I think people are way more predictable maybe than they'd like to think.
Mm.
Yeah, you could see people's reaction to that.
Yeah, you're like, this is fucked up. How do you even know what I do in my spare time? and you get it off a personality test. You know, like, you can just, I'm sure you're really well trained in it, but you can like guess how people are going to react in situations having known them for 10 minutes. Based off tests or just, you know, different types of techniques, I'm sure.
Yeah, totally. And actually it's part of the problem. Everyone kind of wants to be special and unique. And then their problem makes them feel special and unique. Like for me, chronic fatigue, I guess, gave me this kind of badge. It also gave me an excuse. It was an excuse for failing, which made it really hard to let go of. But people have an anxiety problem with panic attacks. For long enough, it becomes a part of them that they want to protect because it feels like it makes them different from everyone else. Mm. But the irony is we think we want different, but actually we don't know the root. We want the same. We want connection. We want empathy. We want to feel belonging. And if we're feeling different, like an outsider and wrong, which is what it ends up happening, then of course we don't get those things. So this sort of self-fueling cycle.
Mm. I feel like I've got a lot of people around me that, because I've recently gone through this evolution, I want to like help them as much as possible. And I'm sure there's people listening to this who are obviously becoming aware of it in themselves, but also they see it in others as well. How is it, like, what is the best process to approach that? Because, you know, it is, you see it as, well, it was so limiting for me, and now I feel like I'm making so much progress, and I want that for other people. But it's a tricky subject because people aren't always aware that they have these things. So what is the best process, or what have you seen as a good process of approaching this situation with other people around you that you really love and you want to help them? You know, make similar inroads.
You want to encourage them to go on the same sort of journey?
Yeah, or just at least start the path of self-awareness of just like, you know, without, you know, coming off like a dickhead, but just being like, you know, there is stuff that you know about, obviously, because you're close to that person, that's happened in their past that you can see is probably rubbing and affecting them in a way, and they're blocked and they can't come forward, or you see the pattern in them. They always repeat this same pattern. It's a negative pattern. You want to help them, but you just don't know where to start.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really, really important question, actually. And it's a difficult one to answer because, you know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. You can't force anyone into therapy if they're not ready to do it. And if they don't want to do it for themselves, it's going to be a really difficult time. And you can't therapize someone. It can't be done to you. So if you're not in, then you're not in. But I think the best answer I have to that is to live by example. Because if you've got people around you, particularly close people, and they witness the change you make, and even if they aren't really consciously aware of it, because you don't need to shove it down their throat, you don't need to explain it because they won't get it. But if they start to see how much better you are, it will seed the idea. And then you just, what's really important is having the faith that everybody has the capacity to do this and that they will when they're ready, as long as you give them the right kind of support. Because if you just try to make them do it, they'll put them in a rebellious mindset and they will probably resist it, the idea of therapy, for way longer than they would have done otherwise, because they're like, well, I don't want to go and do this because everyone's trying to make me do this. And who wants to do something that everyone makes them do? No one. If it's our own choice, then we'll go into it guns a-blazing, but we can't be forced. So I think really living by example is the best example you can set.
It's like a training program.
I was going to say that. It's just like all things, right?
It's like if Locke tells me about a training program, there's almost no way I'm going to do this. But if he comes in and he's got 3 inches on his arms, like, I'll be doing it. Because like, this is guaranteed, right? It's literally like anything. And it's almost like if you want someone to do it, as long as you get to a certain level, they're almost guaranteed to do it. You know, if someone's like, you should invest in Bitcoin, I'm like, probably not going to do it. But if they start rolling up in Lamborghinis... and they were on a skateboard the week before, like, I'm in. If you get to a certain point, like, if you develop really, really well out of seeing a psychologist, like, they're going to get sold. You can't hold them out unless they're, you know, very unique.
Yeah, and you do it for yourself. Because if you were doing it for, obviously, these examples are quite clear, but if you were doing it to get better so that they would see you get better and then get there themselves, it wouldn't work, actually. It would end up causing more drama. But you just do it for yourself. The whole point of all of this is actually getting brave enough to put our needs first and getting skilled and brave enough to state our needs when we need to ask for what we need. Like if everybody in the world woke up tomorrow morning and could actually ask for what they needed, I think that we would have world peace. If people took 100% responsibility for getting what they genuinely needed rather than trying to resort to manipulative, coercive methods of getting what they need. Like any ineffective, conflicted relationship is based on people trying to manipulate each other into doing what they want, even manipulating each other into staying in the relationship. People will stay in the place of victim because they see their partner as a rescuer and they think, you're only in this relationship because you need to rescue me, so I need to stay one down in order for you to have a place here. And the partner, the rescuer partner, is doing the same thing. They're saying they're keeping the victim in one down because they're saying, if you need me to rescue you, then you can't exit the relationship. So that's not love. It's a business transaction, and it's one that isn't equal. One person is in the one up, and the other one's in the one down. And so I guess what I'm getting at with that is the moment we think about trying to rescue people, we are not putting our needs first. We're putting their needs first. And it won't end up having the effect you want it to have. But if we do all these things because we genuinely need it and we're genuinely benefiting from it, then the people around us will change. And if they don't change, they'll exit. And we'll find ourselves over time with a different group of friends. And you can really know how you're doing in the process of sort of self-awareness by checking out the four or five people closest to you and asking yourself how much you really, really like them. And if you get a massive yes, then you are doing well.
No, that is one thing I noticed a dramatic shift in was when I was surrounding myself with people that I feel like they're good people and they weren't negatively. I think this is what happens in a lot of situations, and it's why it happens so often, is because they're still good people. They just have their own problems that they're not really dealing with. And obviously 95% of shit we do is subconscious. Their values and their behaviors and their patterns, they'll rub off on you, right? Which is why they say you're the average of the five people you spend the most time with. It's nothing that you're doing consciously. You're not saying, that's a cool trait, I'm going to do that now. It's happening subconsciously. They say, oh, that person's a piece of shit. You kind of just check that. It goes in the subconscious. And then next time you see that person, it's there. But you haven't consciously recognized it. And so that, over time, wears on you a little bit. And I found that I couldn't get out of those patterns, those inner dialogue, until I completely removed myself from everyone. And I was like, only by myself. And I actually had a fear of being by myself and being with my own thoughts. And then when I spent a good few weeks just with myself, then I started to realize, by recognizing my own behaviors first and patterns, I saw it in other people. And I knew, and then I thought, okay, I'm good now. So I've kind of fixed some stuff. I'm on the right path. And I stepped back into that relationship or had an interaction there. And I was like, whoa, that's super toxic. I can't be in that anymore. Like, I just, it was this really physical feeling, like, of like tightness in my chest, short of breath, anxiety. I was like, I cannot go back to that relationship. And that has never happened to me before. I just thought, oh, I can handle it. Like, they just do their thing, I do my thing. But having had a small evolution in myself, step back with them, I was like, nah, can't do it. And I just had to distance myself. And I think it's not until people do that that they'll realize how dangerous and toxic certain people can be around them.
Yeah. You need to, have you come across the Cartman's drama triangle?
No.
Drama triangle. Drama triangle is amazing. And it sounds like a porno, but it isn't.
It might be.
I've written about it in my book, actually. Maybe I'll see if I can get the publishers to send you a copy of the book when it's out in paperback, and it's because you'll read it and you'll go, oh my god, yeah, this is it. I'm not going to explain it here because it would take too long to go into it in detail, but it's about victims and rescuers and persecutors and how we play this game. And what you're describing here is recognizing basically drama relationships, because when we're in the drama relationship, when we're playing that game, we just feel totally helpless. We end up feeling totally victimized. And we're doing it to ourselves. We are doing it to ourselves by being there. But we don't realize that we have a choice until we get that level of self-awareness that you're talking about there. Mm. And the level of self-acceptance required to say, actually, you know what? This isn't okay. This relationship isn't okay, so I'm out. Or what you just said just then isn't okay. Don't say it again or I'll leave. These are the behaviors that we need to have to avoid drama. And they're the things that people are the worst at, because we're all too afraid of offending people. We're all too afraid of being alone. We're all too afraid of all the stuff that we think we'll get if the rejection that we risk by being honest.
Yeah. Yeah. My therapist was saying every time you get that, you have like these three options that, or three default patterns. And one of the default patterns, I can't remember the other two. I just remember the one that I would do often was compliance. And so like something would happen, I would disagree with it. It wouldn't align with my values. But instead of stepping back and being like, no, this is what I'm about. And so, no, I would just comply. And I would comply and comply and comply until it got to the point where like I wasn't being who I actually am. And then that was creating a lot of anxiety and tension and all that sort of stuff. But look, I feel like we could rag on about this till the end of time. I think we should dive into the final four questions, which is actually going to be some interesting answers here. So we'll kick it off. Hazel first.
No pressure.
Yeah.
Right, excellent. Like, maybe
well
not.
Thought out
maybe
and
not.
Planned answers.
Yeah, so I'm setting the stage for inevitable failure. So the first question is the interview question. Hazel, if you had an opportunity to sit down and interview anyone alive today, who would you choose and why?
So my partner and a good friend of mine last night had a massive conversation about this, because I was really struggling to answer. All the people I thought of that I wanted to interview are really open people. And I was like, this is not making use of my honesty gift that I've got in this question. The question is, you know, they have to be alive and they have to answer honestly. So I need someone that I want to actually, you know, get something out of that they wouldn't otherwise say. So I otherwise, you know, I'd want to sort of interview like David Attenborough or someone like that, because I just want to meet him. But so I thought, what I do actually have someone in mind, but I'm not going to say the name because I don't want to like scandalize. But basically it could apply to any of the like self-help mental health gurus on like Instagram or Facebook that make the understandable but inexcusable error of touting 100% positivity, 100% happiness, 100% calm. Like, there are lots of people out there that do it brilliantly, and they walk the line realistically, and they say, I'm calmer than I used to be, but I still have anxiety. I'm healthier than I used to be, but I still have bad days. That's the message we need to hear, because at the moment the world is giving us this totally unachievable idea of being 100% happy, like body positivity. I'm 100% happy with my body 100% of the time. No, you're not. No one is. Like, I'm 100% calm all the time. The person I was thinking of is a meditation expert, clearly very experienced and good at what he does. But his calm was the most unbelievable, as in I didn't believe it, thing I've ever seen. You could see his defensiveness. You could see this fake pause that he would do whenever you asked him a question. You'd go, and like almost like adopt this sort of Buddha pose before he answered the question. And none of it was authentic. None of it was believable. Yeah, totally. And he was saying, I really have found inner peace. And I was like, no, you haven't. You haven't. And it's irresponsible to say you have, because people are going to try and get that. They're going to try and achieve it, and then they have a day of anxiety, and they're going to think they're failures, and they're going to think they're doing it wrong, and they're not. They're just human. So I would use my honesty interview to expose the fears of the people who pretend they don't have them.
It's the age old saying, "Don't meet your heroes," because it's not that your heroes are bad people. It's that the story you tell yourself about who they are is never who they are, because no one's perfect, and that's what you expect. You meet them and you're like, all right, this person is flawless. And they might, I don't know, toss some rubbish on the ground or something, right? Yeah. And they might swear a bit too much.
Generally, they like completely ignore you. That's like the usual thing, right? You meet someone famous, I've had this so many times, and then they treat you like shit because you're a nobody to them. And it's such an eye-opening experience.
Yeah. And it's not like you would do the same thing, but it's just the story you've told yourself never will align with that person because you don't know them. You don't know who they are as a person.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Can I ask one follow-up? Is there anyone who's like really famous that does it really well? Like we might know on Instagram or whatever?
I mean, actually, I was going to recommend her. I was going to say her book for the book. But Brené Brown is the one to look to for this stuff. She's literally single-handedly changed the world with her two TED Talks on vulnerability and shame. And she does it brilliantly because she backs everything with research. She is a scientist at heart, and she's also a human being who has learned and obviously struggled on this journey of learning how to be herself and to speak her truth and all that stuff that we need to learn to do that we don't. So she's the one to look at. She's got a Netflix program on at the moment. It's like an hour and a half Netflix talk with Brené Brown. So everyone can really get good exposure to that now. So that's what I'd recommend.
Have you ever listened to a guy called Jay Shetty?
I know of him. I think I follow him on Instagram. I don't actually think I've paid that much attention to him, so I can't really remember what he's like.
I just was curious about what you thought about his ideas. He's pretty good with his stuff, and he always uses, on his podcast that I listen to sometimes, he has some pretty relatable examples where he'll say like, oh, you know, this circumstance is this, but you think it's going to go this way, but the reality is it's actually more like this, and it's okay to be. He's just like he's very real about his examples. And if anyone's like listening to this, he has a good podcast called On Purpose with Jay Shetty. It's not something that you listen to, I don't think, all the time, because it's like very specific help for like very specific topics. But if you obviously are going through any of those situations, it is very helpful. He has a video on Facebook which has 1 billion views.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. It's about the world. It's basically about negative media and like fake news and stuff. Yeah, it's really good.
Wow.
We'll post it up in the show notes.
Is it ironic? Like it's fake. Like it's not a billion views. It's like 1,000.
That's fake news.
That's the point of it.
That was fake news. Okay. So second question, Hazel. What is something that you do every single day that you feel like is essential to the success of your day?
Okay, so I'm really, really bad with routines. I'm like not a routine person at all. And this actually was a thing that I used to kind of shame myself on. Like, you know, healthy people are supposed to have routines, supposed to have morning routines and rituals. And I don't have any because I'm a bit of a cereal enthusiast with stuff. So I'll be like, okay, right now I'm really enjoying green smoothies. And so I'll be totally drinking a green smoothie every day for sort of 4 or 5 weeks, and then I'm not interested in green smoothies anymore because I'll wait for the next time for it to come around. So I don't have rituals. I mean, sleep is the actual real answer to that question, because I know that if I don't get a good amount of sleep, then I'm useless. But yeah, in terms of routines and rituals, I'm rubbish at them. I don't have any. I don't have a meditation routine. I meditate sometimes. I don't even have training routines because I've got to listen to my body. So if I say I'm always going to do my sprint training on Tuesday or something, then I'm back in the old place. So now it's like, it's Tuesday. What do I fancy? And what's my body asking for? So I make my decisions that way.
Mm. Yeah, I think we just spoke with Andy Galpin. Again, he had a similar answer. He's a bit more aggressive in his delivery. Yeah. But he basically said he doesn't like that question because people get hung up on a routine being a savior to whatever problem they have. And if they lose that routine, then as a result, they can't perform at their optimal peak. And I agreed with him. I think that routines come and go, at least for me, in my experience, they come and go in and out, just depending on what area of your life you're in. Sometimes you're in a place where you need to meditate more. And so you meditate effortlessly for 50 days straight, but then you might not do it for 100 days after that. But at the time, that's what you really needed. Or journaling, right? Some people like to journal a lot, very often, and then other times in their life they might not pick up the pen at all and they don't need it. They're in the same happy state. So I think there are some routines which stick with us. I think for Raf and I, because we are so health and fitness focused with everything we do, there are some stuff like water and stretching and that sort of stuff that we just do every single day, because it's, we almost feel like it's medicine for the body. But other things as well, I see in my own life, they come and go when they're needed.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, a routine is a habit, and habits, by definition, are not a reaction to what's actually going on around you right now. And so if you get so habituated into something that you're going to do it no matter what your day is like, then there'll be some days when it's the wrong thing to do and you're just doing it because it's a habit. Mm. It's all, you know, it has to be a behavior from the past to be a habit. So, yeah, like routine, definitely. Routinely drinking water, no problem with that.
Yeah.
And the routinely stretching, no problem with that. But saying I have to do an hour's meditation every day and half an hour's journaling, otherwise my day is going to be crap, is clearly a bit of a self-destructive decision. Because that hour and a half on lots of days will be better spent elsewhere.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, there's... I won't get into it right now. Okay, so third question is, what is something recently that you have change your mind on that for a while was a strong held belief of yours? Maybe we can go the time frame of like a year.
Oh, in a year? Oh, crap. Well, I'm going to answer that.
Give us what you had.
What I was going to say was believing in talent. I don't believe, I used to be very much in a fixed mindset as opposed to a growth mindset. I thought people were either good at things or not good at things. And I held on to that idea because I wanted to be a person who was good at sports, and I wanted to be a person who was good at other stuff that I did. And it made me feel like I had some kind of superiority, some kind of God-given gift when I was good at things. And so I had to let go. I had to let go of that and recognize that actually I'm a human being and I have the capacity to learn and do things, and just as everybody else does. And you have to be that in that mindset as a therapist, because otherwise half the people who come to the door, I think, oh, they're probably not going to get better. Mm. And if I thought that, then I'm not going to help them. So I don't believe in talent, and I get into arguments about it constantly. People go, but what about this person and what about that person? Yeah, and there are some outliers who clearly have some freakish stuff going on, you know, the Mozarts of this world. And there are some people who get stuff really early in life, like people who are 10 years old and already playing exceptional tennis or already making amazing music. But it will be because those first 10 years of their life have given them what they needed to develop it. And even me walking into the kickboxing gym and being good right at the beginning, it's not because I had an innate gift for kickboxing. It's because I'd been practicing being aggressive, and I'd been practicing lifting barrels, and I'd been practicing, and I was a dancer at school and an athlete, you know, so I had the coordination and the strength. That's what meant that I was good when I walked in there. It wasn't a gift.
Mm. Yeah, that's good. You share the same perspective as a guy, Christian Thibodeau, this French-Canadian that we had on, who reckons that there is no such thing as talent. It's all to do with your developmental years. And so, like, if you had the perfect program and the perfect environmental factors for a baby, and you just, like, put it through this perfect program, which you never would, but he's like, you could make, you know, ex-baby, this kind of superstar or this sort of thing. And everyone would be like, oh, it's talent, it's this, it's that. It's like, nah, I just took the very, very, very early learning stages and gave them all the skills and environment that they needed to develop those things far better than every other kid that's sitting on their phone now, wasting time, eating shit food, you know, not getting out in nature, not running, doesn't have brothers and sisters to challenge them all the time and just has lazy parents. He's like, they're not untalented. Yeah. They just didn't have the right environment growing up, so they don't have the skills necessary.
Yeah. And it's insulting to say to someone who's made it really successfully in whatever they're doing that they're talented, because it just dismisses all of the work they've put into it. Mm. People only start talking about talent, really, when someone's amazing. They go, oh, Rafa Nadal, so talented. Mm. It's like, dude, he's worked really hard to be as good at tennis as he is. Mm. Like, don't just discredit. They didn't just walk in off the street and beat Federer. Right? So, yeah. Talent. It's not useful. It's not a helpful belief system.
Mm. Do you find that, just sort of as a follow-up conversation, that a lot of the people that, you know, obviously we're not revealing anyone's identity, but a lot of people that you work with have excelled, you know, that do have some of the issues that we've talked about in the last hour or so, have excelled tremendously in like one aspect of their life, and almost in a way where people look at them and be like, wow, I can't believe you grew that business, or like, you know, you're so musically talented, or, you know, you're such a good athlete, but, you know, they don't see, obviously, the whole picture, and they just, like, it would almost be shocking for someone like us who, say, like, value a really successful business to then find out that that person struggles in almost every other aspect of their life.
Yeah.
Is that a
Concern? I think, you, as a rule of thumb, you can, well, everyone's struggling with something, right?
Of course.
Everyone is. So you can always safely assume that somebody, no matter how successful they are, there's something going on, because no one's got like that internet lie about the perfect life, doesn't it? It's not for real. But yeah, I guess that it can be heaped, the intensity can be worsened by somebody having extreme success, because the way I put it often is that the fear of failure and the insecurities and stuff, the imposter syndrome gets worse when the successes get bigger, because the bigger the goal is you're chasing, the bigger the beast is that follows, you know, the higher you climb, the further it is to fall back down again. So yeah, I think that we can pretty much assume that most people who have gone and really excelled in one area of their life have either dealt with or, you know, a pretty big monster, or have got one hot on their heels.
Mm. Interesting. Mm. Nice. And final question is a book that you would share for everyone. I think you just mentioned it. And then if you have one, a favorite quote of yours.
I was just going to say, I was going to say anything by Brené Brown, because I really just do this. It's a really boring answer because she's so popular, but she just can't be beaten. And everything we've been talking about today, the empathy stuff and the shame and the fear and everything we've been talking about is that's her thing, and she explains it better than anyone else. So, and if you're going to start with a Brené Brown book, start with Daring Greatly. It rocked my world, totally changed my life, and I thank her very much for it. A quote. This is a really famous quote, and I only came across it just recently, and it's about the talent thing again. Einstein said, "Everyone's a genius, but if you judge a fish on its ability to climb trees, it will live its life believing it's stupid." And so I like that, because so many people, you know, people come into the therapy room and they have limiting beliefs, whether it's I'm stupid, I'm ugly, I'm not lovable, I don't fit in, I'm not worthy, whatever. And people often ask me, like, what do you do when you just think it's probably true? And I'm like, I don't think it's true. Not one. I must have seen over 1,000 clients, and not one person sat down and told me their limiting belief and me thought, yeah, you're probably right. Like, not once, because they're clearly fictional. No, there is no magical enough line for us to fall short of. No one is fundamentally stupid. Everyone's good at something. No one is fundamentally unlovable. Everyone is loved and lovable by someone. No one doesn't fit in anywhere. But we can get into this place where we completely believe these stories that we tell ourselves, and that's when we slide right back down to that victim end of the scale and life starts to hurt. So, but we all need to stop judging ourselves, judging our fish selves on our ability to climb trees, and actually have a think about what our real purpose is and what our real skill set is, and how we can be the best versions of ourselves, not fit into some model that's been prescribed by someone else.
Mm. Powerful stuff. So where can we get more information on you? You mentioned a book a few times, Hazel, a website, or maybe even your practice. If anyone's local, we do have a lot of UK listeners as well. So just share.
I also see clients over I see clients over Zoom. So I've actually got a few clients at the moment in Australia, which is always difficult. As you guys know, yeah. Making this timescale fit is just a nightmare. My website is hazelgale.com. And if you want to see some mind monsters, you can find some of those on mindmonsters.online. And on Instagram, I'm hazel.gale.therapy. And Gale is spelled G-A-L-E, by the way. That's probably those are the main areas. Oh, on Medium, I've got lots of articles on Medium that are, you know, easily accessible. And so my Medium account is Hazel Gale, again, G-A-L-E. So that's pretty easy to come across. And I really welcome anyone who wants to ask a question, so they can send me an email through my website. That's absolutely fine. Or to my web address, which is hazel@hazelgale.co.uk. I'm going on too long with this now. I've lost my chain of thought. It's impossible. Every time someone asks you this question, it gets longer and longer, doesn't it? It's like 2 million social accounts.
Yeah.
But the last thing I'll say is I would really love to see some monsters. So if anyone watching this goes and looks at the monsters website and thinks, I could put one together. It doesn't have to be well drawn. It doesn't have to be crazy insightful. It just has to be real. Lots of my favorite ones are the ones that aren't drawn well, because they've got so much more character to them, and they're just, nobody's tried to perfect them. They're just like, they're real. All you do is you draw a picture, or you paint a picture, or whatever it is, however it is, what you want to make this thing. You answer 6 questions and you send it to my email address. And the instructions to do that are on the Mind Monsters website, on the page. I think it's called Meet Your Monster.
Web address again?
The Mind Monster website is mindmonsters.online.
Mindmonsters.online.
I would take you up on that, but my strongest limiting belief is I'm bad at art. So
no, but you can just...
That's the perfect reason to do it.
There you go, bro. Yeah, I'm looking at some hectic ones now. Yeah.
Do you know, when I was writing the book,
I'm not that bad, in fact.
When I was writing the book, I found myself halfway through it saying to someone for like the umpteenth time, they were saying, "How's the book going?" I was going, "Yeah, it's going really well. Like the logic sections are really great. I struggle with the anecdotes and stuff because I'm not good at creative writing." And then I said it for like the sixth time or something like that in the process of a few months, and went, "Hang on a minute, that's a limiting belief." And in that moment, I remembered getting told off for bad creative writing in one English class when I was probably about 15, and realized that I had just taken that as a truth. I just assumed that because a teacher had said it, it was true. I'm bad at creative writing, never try. And it just shifted with that memory. I didn't even need to do the work on it. I just realized where it had come from. And from that point forward, the creative writing parts were by far my favorite part of writing the book. And everything I've been doing since has been so much more creative too, because those limiting beliefs, they're not true. You're not bad at art. You just haven't developed the skill yet. You've been trying to climb a tree.
That's right. Fantastic. All right, Hazel, thank you so much for being on the show. This was something a little bit different today, but I think the listeners will get tons of value out of it. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
There it is, guys. What a special podcast that just came out of nowhere, really. So thank you so much to Hazel. Guys, please go give her a follow. Maybe send her a message. Go on the Little Monsters page as well, the Mind Monsters, and check that out there. If you go to activatingnutrients.com as well, guys, after you look after your mental health today, you can look after your physical health it's all connected, but Activated Nutrients is the all-in-one product that's going to help you guys conquer basically anything you got going during the day, right? It covers all your vitamins and mineral needs. When you're not feeling optimal, it's probably because you're missing out on a few of them. It's probably not in your food groups, in your whole foods. This is the best way to find it, best way to cover it off, tick that box for the day. So activatednutrients.com. If you buy a single product, offer MMP, one word, and you can get 20% off. And then as well, guys, if you go to beyondmacros.com, you can consult with Matt Walrath. Or if you want to check out his podcast, Beyond Macros Podcast, then you can go there and you can get just easy, fun, short nutrition information that's going to help you out. Guys, if you enjoyed this episode, make sure you screenshot it, share it on your Instagram stories, tag us, and then we will share it as well. Guys, thank you so much for listening. We appreciate you as always. We really hope you enjoyed this podcast and we'll see you next week. Thank you, Project, for tuning in again to another episode of the My Muscle Project. We release an episode every single Monday. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, the My Muscle Project, to stay up to date with everything we're doing. And if you have some time, leave us a review and a 5-star rating on iTunes.
And don't forget, we have a second show of the week, The After Show. So it's no longer a rest day on Thursdays. If you have any questions for Lachlan and I for that show, head to themindmuscleproject.com/theaftershow. And if you ask a question, we'll answer it on the show.
Thanks again so much, Project, and we'll see you all next week.